This is Aiden with Oddball Pilots. I'm sitting down with Alex Haynes in Seattle, Washington. This will be the first lesson about ferry flying. And the first one will be an introduction to ferry flying, namely, what is a ferry flight? And a quick introduction to Alex. Alex is the pilot who I did my first ferry flight across the Atlantic with. And he's been ferrying planes for over 15 years. So he's the expert, and I'm just here to listen just like the rest of you.
So, well, I consider myself a journeyman. There are guys who ferried 500 airplanes across the ocean before GPS. Those, in my mind, are the real ferry pilots. But of those of us that are around today, there are a few that can do it full time. That can take any airplane from anywhere in the world to anywhere else at any time of year. And know enough of the ins and outs that we can pull it off. And I think that's kind of makes the distinction today of who the ferry pilots are.
Okay, but not all ferry pilots are starting out at that higher level. I mean, what's the range for pilots who are ferrying planes?
A few guys get really lucky, and they get right into a turbine, and they get, you know, nice pay, nice routes, but most ferry pilots have to start flying single-engine pistons. And most single-engine pistons are manufactured in the United States. And the market overseas, the biggest market for those overseas is in Europe. So there's a steady stream of airplanes going back and forth, island hopping, across the Atlantic Ocean in all seasons.
So the greatest majority of ferry flights are going to be from the U.S., from a manufacturing center, Wichita, would be a common one, over to Europe.
So Cessna's in Wichita. There's Piper is down in Vero Beach. And new planes go overseas. They go all over the world. And old planes come back. There's a few planes that are manufactured overseas, like Pilatus is made in Switzerland. Those get brought over. There's a steady stream of those flying over. And other planes. But generally, most planes in the world are manufactured in the United States. And if you go anywhere in the world, like Australia or South Africa or some island in the middle of the Pacific, and you see a little airplane, a ferry pilot flew it there.
Somehow.
If it's really small, like a Cessna 152, they might have taken the wings off and put it in a shipping container and shipped it there. But if it's any bigger than that, I promise you, some sucker got in that airplane and flew it halfway around the world and delivered it.
So why don't more planes get boxed up and shipped in crates?
With a really small plane, it makes sense because there are a lot of obstacles to getting a small plane that flies really slow and doesn't have a lot of range, getting it halfway around the world. And a bigger plane like a Cessna Caravan, if you take the wings off, that's a very big deal and it's time consuming. And we can jump in that plane anywhere in the world and have it anywhere else in the world in under a week if everything goes right.
And there are also damage issues with crating it, I would think.
Oh, yeah. Anything can happen. It can be lost at sea, but generally you're going to mess it up. A nice plane. I've been doing Quest Kodiaks. They're made in Sandpoint, Idaho. They're going to China. I'm going up through Alaska and Russia. I can get it over there in about 4 days. No sweat. Weather permitting. But if they were to put it in a box, there'd be a lot of labor dismantling it and reassembling it. It would be time consuming. It would be time consuming to ship it. There'd be a different kind of insurance. So sometimes it makes sense, but with most aircraft, it makes much better business sense to ferry it.
Okay. And the pilots ferrying them, you mentioned earlier that, you know, you're flying jets now and Kodiaks.
Mostly turboprops.
Okay.
I'm mainly a caravan guy. The first ferry pilots were, you know, way back between the First and Second World War, I would say. And they pioneered the routes, and a lot of the airstrips in the North Atlantic were constructed for the Second World War. And then when we flew God knows how many hundreds of thousands of airplanes across the Atlantic.
On the Lend-Lease program.
Yeah. And during Lend-Lease and after, when we were already, that was before we were actually in the war. But once we were in the war, then we had our own people flying our own planes to go over there and fly our own missions over in Europe. And those were the real pioneers of ferry flying.
And they were often low time. I mean, they were qualified Air Force pilots. There were a lot of females who flew too, I think.
Yeah, the Wasps.
Yeah, the Wasps flew a lot of ferry flights, and they were often...
Because they weren't allowed to fly in combat.
Right.
So while the guys were training for combat and flying in combat, the women could actually ferry the planes.
And I don't have the fatality rates, but I think on those ferry flights it was significant. Their planes all over Alaska.
Well, nothing was de-iced.
And they didn't... Well, they...
And they weren't instrument rated.
And they're using ADFs, if they were lucky. Celestial navigation, ADF, if you like, and dead reckoning.
So there are a handful of these people still alive. And they trained the generation that trained me.
Huh.
So the generation that they trained, there's a few of these people out there still flying. And they're so experienced that they've got 500 or 800 or 1,000 deliveries. And they did more than half of those before GPS in like 1991 or so, when the first like Garmin 100 portable came out. You could chuck it up on the glare shield and go anywhere without thinking about it too hard.
Right now in the 50s, I think what they stood, the Navy put ships out in the Atlantic, the Pacific as ADF.
There was, ADF, for instance, there was one halfway to Hawaii. So if the only long range navigation you had was ADF, usually the range on those ADFs was only a few hundred miles. So you had a dead reckon for 1,000 or 1,500 miles, and then you would start to pick up and you could home in on it as long as it was working. These are the ones that were like set up on land.
Okay.
So what the U.S. Coast Guard, the Navy did, I don't know what other governments did this, but I know the United States did in the Pacific and the Atlantic, is they had stationary vessels that lived in a certain position, and I can't remember their call signs, but for instance, there was one halfway to Hawaii. So you would take off from Oakland, and you would dead reckon for 500 miles, and you would start to pick up this NDB that was actually on a ship, and you would navigate to that ship, and then you could navigate outbound on that. So the first 1,000 miles to get to that ship, and then you had another 1,000 miles to get to Hawaii. So this, but then past Hawaii, they didn't necessarily have those.
And that's what Amelia Earhart, too, when she disappeared, there was a Navy ship with an ADF that she was trying to home in on. And of course, speculation is that her ADF was broken or she didn't know how to use it.
Well, they're subject to all kinds of anomalies, interference, attenuation, and so they're not as reliable.
Right. Those were set up mainly for the airliners running their normal routes.
A ferry pilot will learn to use whatever resources are out there. So the government has resources established for the military. The airlines have their own resources. Most of the runways were built by the government. And the radio navigation aids, I mean, look, today we've got GPS. That's the U.S. government.
Right.
So we depend completely on other people's resources to do our job.
Huh. Yeah, that's right. When you get to Europe, you don't find nearly as many GPS approaches because they won't use U.S. government satellites. I think that's correct. I don't think there are any. They're trying to set up their own system now, but they don't trust us not to shut them off.
But when you go to Africa, there are plenty of GPS overlays because they're never going to have the ability to come up with their own.
So let's go back. So the ferry flying structure, you could say, and the ferry flying culture kind of developed really during World War II with the Lend-Lease and the ferrying aircraft over to Europe and Russia to fight the war. And then that continued on for more commercial reasons after the war in the 50s, 60s, and today.
Right. So during the war, when these pioneers established these routes until I became milk runs. You can read about it in Ernest K. Gann, Fate as the Hunter, going into Greenland in a DC-3. Now, he wasn't necessarily a pioneer, because he was along for the ride. He still had to do the flying and become experienced with the route, so that later times when the more experienced people weren't there in the cockpit with him, then he would be the guy right. who would have the experience.
Typical FO, first officer position.
Right.
He's learning the routes.
There's an axiom. Do you remember what this is? It's like with seatbelts. The theory is that there were a certain number of accidents and fatalities, and then we slow down the speed limit and we make everybody wear a seatbelt. Well, then their driving behavior is more risky because they know they have airbags and seatbelts and it's safer. Well, it's the same thing now with GPS.
Oh, yeah. No, it happened in Alaska, too.
Is that people, pilots, would, they didn't have that, it wasn't that easy.
Right.
So they had to use dead reckoning and celestial navigation, and they had to use drift sights, like Lindbergh did.
Right.
And they had to keep a really, really carefully accurate, nav log. And with GPS, you can just set it on autopilot and take a nap.
So it used to be that you needed your skill level had to be at a certain, fairly high, even to contemplate one of these flights. And now it's the skill levels of people thinking these flights may have decreased because everybody's just like, well, I'll just plug in the GPS.
So, yeah, anybody can just climb in a plane with a GPS and navigate to somewhere, but there are a lot of other factors that matter. Bob Davis and I were flying two amphibian caravans to the Maldives from Connecticut. And we had ferry tanks on board, but we still needed to go up through Iceland. And we had taken off from Goose Bay, Labrador that morning, and we were talking to this kid that was working for a guy out of New Jersey. And this kid was flying a Piper Archer, and he was delivering it to Europe. This was, I think, in about 1998. Bob and I were getting paid $2,500, and the trip would take us about a week. I think we had six legs to get all the way to the Maldives. We had large ferry tanks in the back, but the winds and the weather dictated that we couldn't make it straight across the Atlantic, so we had to go from Goose Bay, Labrador to Reykjavik, Iceland. And this kid was in an Archer on the same route. But he had to stop in Greenland, because he didn't have a ferry tank on board. And it was his third trip out, ever. And he had never been trained properly, because he had never flown with a seasoned ferry pilot. And it was January. So put yourself in this kid's shoes. He's been across the North Atlantic a couple of times, but he didn't have the experience to really understand what he was up against. He wasn't seasoned yet. He hadn't been properly trained. He was out there in a single-engine piston in the dead of winter.
In the Northland.
In the North Atlantic, where the daytime isn't very long, and he was going eastbound, where the days are really short. So he had a lot of decisions to make, and it's easy just to get in and go. But then once you get out there, sometimes you really wish you had stayed. And Bob and I were we were like mother hens that night. We were worried about the guy. We saw him in the morning in Goose. We knew we would get in way ahead of him because we didn't have to stop in Greenland. The weather was good in Greenland. The weather wasn't that good in Iceland. And he would be getting into ice about halfway to Iceland. It would be nighttime. There were layers over the Atlantic within about halfway from Greenland to Iceland. He'd be getting into ice. And if he could find his way through the layers or stay above, he would be fine. And then he would pick up some ice during the descent. But he's also flying a carbureted piston airplane that, you know, you don't just get structural ice or pedo ice. You can get carburetor ice. And, you know, I don't want to insult the guy by, condescending to tell him how to do his job. He's a commercial pilot, and he's out there getting paid to do a job.
What was he getting paid to do the job?
Well, this is what made me so angry, is that he was out there for $900 for a Europe delivery. At the time, Bob and I would get $2,000 if we were delivering the same airplane. And the going rate was between $1,500 and $2,000, all expenses paid. This kid was paying half his own expenses. That meant that his meals, his hotel bills, not the aircraft expenses like fuel and navigation fees and landing fees and parking and hangar if he had to, that would be paid for by the company that he was working for. But his personal expenses, his hotel, his meals, if he wanted to have a drink, he had to pay for half of that. And that's just not right.
Yeah. And you were saying he's taking on a huge risk. He's got ice, and he probably didn't quite understand what the risks were. 100%.
That's right. So, Bob and I, we landed in Iceland, and we should have just gone to the hotel and had a beer and dinner and hung out, but we actually hung out for 2 hours at the FBO with Sven. He still owned the FBO then, and we just waited and drank coffee and waited for this guy to show up. And he showed up, and everything was fine. And then we went to bed, but we just felt like it was really important that we just stayed up. And maybe if something happened, maybe we would be there on the radio to help give him some advice, because there wasn't really much else we could do if he got into trouble. But we had, having just flown in and just come in through those conditions, we were in the best position if he needed help. The point of telling the story of that kid was that if he kept going the way he was going, he'd be lucky if he didn't get into serious trouble at some point, because he didn't have somebody, seriously looking over his shoulder.
Right. And what is the fatality rate per crossing?
The fatality rate per crossing is around 1 in 300.
Okay, so that means 1 out of every 300 crossings doesn't make it back.
Right. And so we got to qualify this, because if you're talking about flying jets,
right.
That doesn't count.
Right.
You're talking about flying small planes that normally wouldn't make it across. And this is where the ferry pilot's niche can be described, because, when Boeing sells a 737, either the airline is going to come or they're going to hire some other company and they're going to fly it, but that's not really a ferry flight.
Right.
Because that plane has got the range, the guys are highly trained, they're only going to be going to long runways with ILSs, they're going to be going to places where their company has already established the routes. It's going to be like a regular airline flight.
Okay.
So they can call it a ferry flight because they are ferrying the airplane to the other side of the world. But that's not the kind of ferry flying that we're talking about. So a ferry flight is somebody somewhere in the world buys an airplane and it has to come from somewhere else that is going to involve an oceanic crossing.
So a ferry flight needs to involve an oceanic crossing. Flying from Florida to New York doesn't count.
We call flying from Florida to New York a repositioning. Or, I met a guy from Nairobi that said he had just ferried a plane up to Entebbe, Uganda. And I heard his feelings when I said, we call that a repositioning. It's the same thing up in, I've taken a new plane to Alaska. Well, that doesn't count.
Yeah.
I am taking the airplane one way and I'm dropping it off. But I don't consider that a ferry flight. That doesn't count. Because, any pilot that's checked out in that airplane could make that trip. The difference with a ferry pilot is that you are trained to fly really long range, extreme long range, across any ocean and any continent at any time of year.
in planes that aren't designed to do this.
Right. So a 172, how long is that normally going to stay in the air? About 5 hours, 5.5 hours?
Okay, five.
We put a 124-gallon tank in the back seat, and you can make that airplane stay in the air for 19 hours if you handle it correctly.
Yeah, I had an 18.5-hour leg in my Cherokee 140.
Well, what about our first leg? You had a Cessna 182.
Yeah.
And you were in the air for 17 hours and change.
I think so.
From Luxor, Egypt to Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. Yeah.
And then we had to like put our suits on and act cheerful. okay, so let's, an easy way to say it would be a ferry flight is going to involve an oceanic crossing of some sort. And it's going to require specialized navigation techniques, specialized equipment.
Well, so a ferry flight is an oceanic flight. It's a combination of flying, if we take off from Kansas or Florida and we go up through the Northeast and Maritime of Canada and across the Atlantic, then we have to go across Europe. And then we have to go across the Mediterranean and the Middle East and then across the Indian Ocean to get to the Far East. So you're a combination of understanding oceanic rules and regulations, how to file an oceanic flight plan, but how to fly the ocean is the most important thing. Then you got to understand flying in all these other countries.
Clearances. So
you have to understand that some countries, all you have to do is file a flight plan, but there are plenty of countries where you have to get permission to fly a foreign registered airplane in that country. Just as the United States requires, we issue permission for aircraft of foreign registry to fly in the United States. You have to understand where the expensive fuel and the cheap fuel is.
Or whether you can even get fuel.
Absolutely. We, are very limited by, we have to say no to a lot of flights because avgas is just not available. We could put big enough tanks in almost any airplane to get it anywhere in the world, literally. But you just can't find the avgas.
You can find $27 a gallon.
Yeah. Well, right now in Egypt, it's $15 a gallon if I'm up to speed on that.
And I think Djibouti's in the 18 to 20 range.
Yeah, so
it's there.
It's phasing out around the world.
Okay, so given that a ferry flight would require an oceanic crossing, let's look at some of the routes that would be standard for a ferry flight.
Part of long-range navigation is that you have to understand that great circle routes really do apply. And you, if you're interested, what you do is you go back to your globe and you take a piece of string and you put one end of the string on Wichita and you put the other end of the string on Johannesburg and it'll show you the shortest route there. And lo and behold, it actually takes you right up over the North Atlantic and through Europe.
Huh.
So it might seem counterintuitive to when you want to go to the southern hemisphere to start out by heading north, but you're actually taking the most direct route. The first Atlantic crossing was actually done, I think, in like 1918 or 1919, and there were something like 20 Navy ships all spread out between Newfoundland and the Azores with fires burning on them, so like beacon fires, and these guys could navigate visually from one to the next. That route is still the Milk Run from St. John's, Newfoundland down to the Azores. And that is kind of the bread and butter route that every ferry pilot has flown.
Okay, so you'd pick the plane up in Wichita, most likely, and then you fly it, you reposition it to...
So we might put a ferry tank in it in Wichita. We might take it all the way up to Bangor, Maine and put a ferry tank in it there. And then we jump on up to Newfoundland. St. John's is way out on the tip. Gander is a little bit further in on the island of Newfoundland. From there, it's 1,400 nautical miles down to Santa Maria in the Azores. That's the longest overwater leg on that route. And then from there to the mainland of Europe, it's another 700 nautical. And then your feet dry, depending on where you're going. Most of these flights, like I said, they're just back and forth between North America and Europe. That's a typical eastbound route. Another typical eastbound route is to, if you have a plane that doesn't have as much range, a lot of small planes, if the winds are right and the weather's right, there's no reason to put a ferry tank in. So you can save time, money, and expenses. You can go right on up to Goose Bay, Labrador, or to Iqaluit, and Frobisher Bay, and Baffin Island. And from there, you can make it across to Greenland, Iceland, and Scotland, and then into mainland Europe. So that's another typical standard route. That's a milk run, a money route.
And you can also launch straight from Bangor for the Azores, too, if you're tanked correctly.
And this is what Steve Hall taught me. He always said, don't mess with the old family recipe. Lots of fuel. So all these other guys, they're coming up from Florida, and they're going up to St. John's, Newfoundland, and going straight across. And they'd go up to Newfoundland and get stuck in this bad weather, because the weather up there is notoriously bad for a number of reasons that we'll get to later. They'd still be stuck there, and I had already left Bangor and gone 2,000 nautical, and skipped Canada completely and gone directly to Santa Maria in the Azores.
If you did get stuck in Newfoundland, do you have any other options besides the Azores?
You can go up to Greenland from there.
Or Shannon.
Or you can jump straight across. I've done this plenty of times from Newfoundland, from Gander, or St. John's, straight across to Prestwick, Scotland, for instance.
Okay.
1,700 miles.
And you'd do that maybe to avoid a bad front that's just south of your course or bad.
Absolutely. Winds. Normally, you would go out to the Azores, but, for instance, I was taking one to East Africa the other day, and the weather was really bad in the central North Atlantic, but the weather north of that was clear and screaming tailwinds, you know, zonal flow straight across out of the west. I went up to Bangor and spent the night, and the next day I took off in the morning, went up to Goose Bay, Labrador, 600 nautical, gas and go across the Atlantic at night, and landed in Jersey in the morning, gas and go, and then down to Malta without stopping to rest. And meanwhile, that weather on the Atlantic was still god-awful, and it was moving up into the British Isles, and it was behind me and not a factor any longer.
So you're like Steve used to always say, you'd always want to run right in front of the storm to get the great winds. So what about the Brazilian route? When would you, that southern route across the Atlantic?
We had a bunch of planes that were going from South America to South Africa, and that makes sense. Obviously, it's thousands of extra miles to go up north, and the legs across the southern Atlantic are shorter, but you're kind of limited in your routes. And you're also in the trade winds. So you're going to, whereas in the North Atlantic, you're going to have tailwinds when you're going east. In the South Atlantic, you're going to have, or around the equator, you're going to have the trade winds. You're going to have headwinds if you're going east. So, but more often when I'm taking the southern route is when I'm taking a plane from Africa back to North America. Because there are two reasons. One is from South Africa, it just makes a little more sense. The route is a little bit shorter to go across from West Africa to Brazil. And you have tailwinds and a leg from Abidjan to Natal or Recife is 2,000 nautical, but you can pare that way down by going up to Dakar or Sal and Cape Verde and taking that on down to Brazil. That's only 1,400 miles. Oh. A place I've never been that all the old timers was Liberia and Sierra Leone, which is the shortest point of approach.
But now politics will keep.
Well, civil war.
So as a ferry pilot, how aware do you have to be of world political situations?
You have to be right on top of it. Because things change all the time. If you were getting cheap fuel in Benghazi about 3 years ago, I think 2 years ago, that could be a real problem, and there you wouldn't dream of going to Benghazi.
Right.
You and I went to Luxor. We landed there the day that Mubarak turned the internet back on. Now, Cairo is a perfectly good stop, but we wouldn't have gone to Cairo on that day. There was way too much unrest going on. I wouldn't have done it. I stop in, I've delivered to Zagreb. Well, the first trainer into Croatia after they stopped shooting at each other. Now we're not flying across the Sudan because they're charging $1,800 a flight. Ever since South Sudan partitioned and now it's two countries, they're trying to make some money because everybody wants to fly that way. So now we have to fly down the Red Sea with our left wing in Yemen and our right wing in Eritrea. But Eritrea and Ethiopia take turns shooting at each other, and then you can't get a clearance for them because they're too busy having a war.
and yeah, small planes flying through an airspace, not a good thing in war.
So, you know, things in those countries, they can be, over a period of years, you can consider that they're changing all the time. So you really have to stay on top of it. Mostly because of expenses, but you can run into real more serious problems that I've been locked up a couple of times. It was always for a very short time, and I never felt like I was ever in any real danger. The next most common ferry route after the Atlantic is going across the Pacific, and you take off out of California, you go to Hawaii, and then there's a number of different islands you can stop. There's a steady stream of airplanes going from the United States to Australia and to the Far East, places like Japan, Korea, Thailand, Malaysia. So this is another milk run.
What seems to be the biggest market over there these days?
There are some piston airplanes, but from the United States, it's more turbines. There are, you know, small biz jets, caravans. If you're some of the other kind of single engine PT-6 powered pressurized planes, like a TBM or a Pilatus, those wouldn't take the Pacific route because they're manufactured in Europe and they would go across Southern Asia to get to Far East Asia.
Okay. Right? Have you seen popular destinations and countries that are buying these planes change since you've been ferry flying?
Yeah, and you know, the market, it goes back and forth. The funny thing is that if you remember in 97, there was a little economic collapse in Asia, and they had bought all these airplanes that we'd ferried out, and they were calling us back to ferry them back. So we were bringing back like a Cessna 406 or a Caravan or something from Malaysia or Nepal. And then you know, the tides of global finance shift again, and they start buying airplanes again. So it's like, as long as there's no global economic downfall, there's always business because these airplanes are always moving in one direction or another.
The economy goes bad in the country, they come back to the U.S.
or somewhere to Europe, right? Or there's an El Nino event in the Indian Ocean, and out-of-season floods have washed out all the roads and bridges in Somalia, Ethiopia, and Kenya. All of a sudden, all these Europeans have UN contracts, and you can't move planes fast enough to East Africa to ride that gravy train.
So the Pacific crossing, you get to Hawaii. From Hawaii, where do most planes, where would you be your next stop?
The next stop for most people is Majuro. Majuro is an island in the Marshall Islands, not far from Bikini, where we tested the hydrogen bomb. There are other places out there like Tarawa, and there are others like Kwajalein or Wake, but those are off limits to the general public because they're still military. U.S. government. These islands like Midway, Kwajalein, Wake, they are U.S. territories. And There are enough stops out there. You don't need to use them. They would be very convenient if we had them to go to. But you can go to them if you really need to. You can file them as an alternate in an emergency. Huh. But like Wake Island, there's high radiation there. There's a place called Johnston Atoll, which is closed now. That's halfway from Honolulu to Majuro, and that's where we incinerated all our, mustard gas and chemical warfare materials. And so that place is like toxic, and you really don't want to go there. But that, Steve Hall used to tell me about how they had seafood on Wednesday night, the seafood, all you could eat seafood buffet, and it was his favorite stop. But it's closed now. You fly right over it, and it's all closed. You can see Johnston Atoll on Google Earth, and it's all overgrown. It's just one little rock with a runway on it in the middle of nowhere, 1,000 miles from anywhere.
From the Marshall Islands, then, can you reach Australia or mainland Asia?
From Majuro, it's 2,300 nautical to Brisbane. I think 21 to Cairns, Australia. So you can make it in one leg. If you had enough gas to make Hawaii from mainland California, then you can make Australia from Majuro. Making it to mainland Asia is going to be another leg. We usually stop in places like Pohnpei or Chuuk or Palau or Guam or Saipan. If you're going up to Japan, I did this in November. I went from Wichita to Chino, California, Honolulu, Majuro, Saipan, and then Osaka. Huh. And it's real easy.
But now that's not on the Great Circle Route.
That's not the Great Circle Route. It's faster to go up through Alaska and Russia. The problem with that is Russia. Russia's expensive, and you have to get clearances. The fuel is expensive, and the clearances are expensive, and you can't just go.
And you need a visa.
Generally, you need a visa if you're going to spend the night in Russia. If you don't have a visa for Russia, I don't know currently if they'll let you just do a quick turn at the airport. So you're not actually going anywhere. You're just landing for fuel. It's a technical stop.
So recently you've been taking Kodiaks over to China and you've been going the north route. What would be your standard routes, your standard stops on that route?
Well, it makes sense to take that route because the airplanes are built in Sandpoint, Idaho, and I live in Seattle. So I can get over to Sandpoint and bring the airplane back over here and get ferry tanks installed here at Boeing Field with my friends at Kenmore Air. From there, I like to go. I leave out at about 6 in the morning. I get up to Anchorage after about 8 or 9 hours, and then I can pop over to Nome and spend the night in Nome. The next day, I go to Petropavlovsk in Kamchatka and I spend the night. And the next day I go to Khabarovsk in mainland Russia, spend the night. And then on the last day I deliver to China. And that's because it's the dead of winter that I'm doing it that way. If it was summertime, the days are much longer, the weather's better, and I can go do a quick turnaround in Petropavlovsk and only spend one night in Russia. But if you plan on doing that in the wintertime, then you're probably going to end up with a problem because you're going to be doing a lot of night flying in bad weather. And so, again, that's one of those judgment calls. You got to be able to plan the trip out so that you don't get caught out. You're halfway out there, and all of a sudden you've got a delay because you're waiting for permission from somebody because you thought you could get there, but now you have to amend your itinerary.
So in this first part of ferry flying, we have covered the two standard oceanic crossings, which are the Atlantic and Pacific Ocean. And each ocean has different routes, a southern and a northern route that you can take. And we discussed both those routes and some merits and demerits to each route choice. In the next lesson, we're going to discuss what you need on board the aircraft before you even leave the U.S. on a ferry flight. Thanks for listening. This is Aiden and Alex with Oddball Pilot.